Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hey, man, it's me. Who are you?
Andrew Main, Brian.
I just said No, not you. I mean this third shifty-eyed guy sitting over on the side.
Oh, that guy? Justin Robert Young.
Hi, guys. It's me. It's me, Justin Robert Young. I'm back on the show.
Finally. In many ways, you'd never left.
By popular demand, I'm here.
Gentlemen, I'm going to jump right into a topic here because I don't know if you noticed, but there's been a political event. And for our international listeners, you probably didn't hear about this because, you know, a lot of news just doesn't make it outside. But every 4 years, we have an election and then we vote and then we use a process like electoral college and whatever. And we elect a new leader or keep the same person in office unless they've already had a term. So our two terms. So anyway, we have a new president, President Donald Trump, which sounds funny to everybody, including him, every time he says it. And there's a lot of speculation what's going to happen next. Now, we're not going to get into all the other political stuff out there because, frankly, my opinions on that stuff is worthless and useless and of no value to anybody. But we can talk about space stuff and weird things and what does this mean? Because every administration can have an effect when it comes to science and technology. They can choose goals, like what directions we want to go into, what are we going to pay attention to, what are we not going to pay attention to. And it is often very – it's hard to sort of read the tea leaves sometimes and see which way something's going to go. President Obama was certainly not – antagonistic towards space, but wasn't exactly very pro either. He continued. There was a program that started in the Bush administration, which was the commercialization of trying to start using private companies to do more of some of the launch stuff and things like that for NASA. Obama continued that and put more funding in that, and it was a great thing that helped SpaceX, ATK and other companies and start developing new technologies. So that was a very, very cool thing. And we've got funding into some new areas there. But there wasn't like a really big space effort. You know, people say, well, you know, he said we should go to Mars. He said this at the end of his end of the 8 years. That was his like closing thing was like, hey, you know, it'd be cool. It'd be to go to Mars. It would have been maybe more helpful if that happened at the start of his first term. But he had his own set of priorities, and which is understandable. Every president, every politician has what they consider important, what they don't. And space was never really a big priority in the previous administration. Now we have the Trump administration, which still trying to figure out what are those priorities going to be. But there was a policy paper which was written by a couple people, including Mark Albrecht, who's Alex Albrecht's father of – Alex Albrecht, who you probably know is a famous
one of our BFFs. Yeah, of course, from the Totally Rad Show.
Yeah, but anyhow, so we have an incoming administration. We're going to have new goals coming in there, and there's been some interesting sort of speculation. Early on, Donald Trump was critical of a lot of the solar industry, electric industry, which set him up to be an antagonist towards Elon Musk. But then Donald Trump brought Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley fund manager, in as his head advisor for technology issues. Peter Thiel spoke on the GOP stage, was the first openly gay person to announce that they were gay and Republican at the primary, and has now since been the one person bringing in a lot of people from Silicon Valley and the tech industry to Trump to meet with him, including Elon Musk, who's had both a public and a private meeting and has now been appointed to or put to an advisory board to give Trump advice on technology issues, which is, I think we would all agree, is kind of like if we want to talk about voices we want in Donald Trump's ear, probably a very good idea. There have been whispers now. Washington Post had an article about this, and there have been some other speculation that, again, there's no confirmation of this, but that there may be the possibility that Trump, who I don't know if you guys know this, likes to do things in a very big, flashy way, apparently. The guy that put gold curtains in the White House likes to do big showpiece kind of, hey, let's everybody look at what we're about to do kind of thing. Story is, rumor is, possibly he's mulling announcing a mission to Mars, like an actual manned mission to Mars, not a NASA timeline where we have an unfunded, not quite sure how we're going to get there, what we're going to do, but like an actual like moonshot thing. He's both talked to apparently Musk about this. He's been talking to another historical journalist, Brinkley, about this, about the idea of, you know, how it was sort of this, in theory, this galvanizing thing of the 1960s. In reality, if you look at the statistics of the number of people who supported the Apollo program, it was never really that. It was never a majority of the country. But nonetheless, in retrospect, it seems like this great thing. We're all on board. So thoughts on this? Pro, con, questions?
So it's really hard to dance through everything without, you know, all the baggage of what this means to one person versus another person. I think that in the past, all of us have expressed extreme concerns over the Obama administration's past policies about, you know, blowing up people without giving a reason on other sides of the world and not disclosing, being the most opaque administration despite their
promise. Well, let's unpack the first half, though. Every administration has done that.
That's fine. That's fine. But you know, his brand was it was very off brand for him to not only double down on that policy but do it bigger than ever. And we expect whatever. But here's my point: is that once you're there, you're thinking, what will I be remembered for? Not what do I do? Not what do I handle stuff day to day? What will I be remembered for? And by and large, the, you know, Obama administration will be remembered as a time of healing, even though they killed more American civilians, blah, 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 you know, whatever. That's day one, I guarantee you. Trump is thinking, what cartoon of what I am actually doing can fit into three lines of a textbook 70 years from now? And, you know, I come from business. I can be remembered as the guy who opened up space. And that's a three sentence words you could say about me and believe it. And in that regard, you know, granted, you know, of course, we all know that that it's the work of SpaceX and the heavy lifting to make it much, much cheaper to get to orbit than at any point in all of human history. I don't care who the guy is that wants to take credit for it. I just want to get to space, bro. I just want to get to space.
I'm going to point out from his inaugural address, and he wrote in part of the address, probably written by Steve Bannon, "We stand at the birth of a new millennium, ready to unlock the mysteries of space, to free the Earth from the miseries of disease, and to harness the energies and industries, technologies of tomorrow." And I just want to point out, like, I was trying to search through there, and I couldn't find previous inaugural addresses that mentioned space. I'm sure there have been, but I haven't. I think this is the first time in decades
As a matter of fact, it was like a big negative during one of the debates, I want to say in 2004, maybe 2000, when like the moment Newt Gingrich mentioned, hey, we should, you know, evaluate the tactical viability and importance of having a base on the moon. Everyone's all like, oh, president upside down crazy sci-fi face over here.
To be fair, Newt Gingrich does plenty of president crazy upside down sideways face kind of things. And certainly I think the skepticism around Newt Gingrich as typified by that comment wasn't necessarily in the moment totally out of place. Although I certainly take your point that the idea of space exploration is kind of in this weird duality. Like, on one hand, we have the Neil deGrasse Tyson's, like, why don't we dream anymore, people? So we often like to feel bad about the fact that we have not done enough. But then also there's the whole, well, why are we putting all this money towards something that we here on Earth think to be frivolous, right? What I think is interesting, and really what I'm fascinated to see play out on a lot of levels, but this one is certainly a big one, is the difference between a private sector mindset versus a political mindset. In a lot of ways, Donald Trump was very successful in the campaign because he just didn't sort of abide by traditional rules of how to run a campaign. He decided to flood the market with information in a field that is normally reserved for people only saying the exact right and field tested four or five words so they can control the message. What in governing in general, politicians think about what is feasible, what it's going to take, who in the Congress is going to say boo about it. Do we have to give them this? Are they going to get those votes? If we do this now, do we still have time within the next 3 months to push another major initiative forward? And if we're to weigh them and rank them, how do we make that list? With all that being said, I think that right now, and I think it's foolhardy for anybody to say that they know what President Trump is going to do, because I don't think anybody does, including himself. But if there's one thing that I do think is real, is that he seems very, very committed to listening, more so than previous presidents, and I'm going to put both parties into this, listening to people in the private sector and asking them, if the government could be at your service, what would you want? And I think the things that we are seeing from this seem to be hallmarks of Peter Thiel and to the extension Elon Musk, because he's the biggest player in the game right now, which is the government should be back in the space game, and now the parts are cheaper, and now the things at our fingertips are closer than they ever have been. If the government were to be at our service, this is what we think it should do. And that, for people who are fans of private space travel, is very interesting, very intriguing. I'm very curious to see where it goes.
Let me give you just some thoughts, because part of the problem is we discuss these things. We often talk about them in the abstract without numbers. And there has been, one of the reasons that previous missions to Mars didn't happen was that NASA went to their contractors and said, let's plan an ambitious mission to Mars. And they came back with programs that cost $250 billion or more. Because when you go to a bunch of government contractors and say, hey, listen, guys, sky's the limit, they're going to go figure out how to go even beyond that, which they did, talking about, well, we'll need a rocket to go into orbit. We'll need a fuel depot in Earth orbit. Then we'll build ships for the moon and special fleets to go there. Then we'll build a rocket system to go from Earth orbit to lunar orbit, or says lunar orbit to Mars, and built an extremely complicated system that basically functioned to keep government contractors employed for the next 20 or 30 years building hardware. It was not, let's build a 727 that can take us anywhere in the solar system. It was, how do we build a humongous pork barrel project that will go to all these states, all these contracts and all that? And it was a disaster. That was clearly what that was. And when NASA was asked to reduce the budget on that, because they started from so many faulty premises, they really couldn't. Versus, we'll say, the SpaceX and Blue Origin approaches. First, build a really useful, reusable craft that could go to, can go to LEO, and it can go beyond and land on other planets.
Right.
So that's SpaceX, the SpaceX ITS. Blue Origin talks about right now they want to build the new Glenn and then the new Armstrong. So that's where that mindset is right now. Budget-wise, SpaceX says they could build their spaceship, tanker, and booster platform, that whole system, for $10 billion. That is how much they pegged the budget at. I would say it's a pretty, probably a highly realistic number, more so now than it would have been if they said that 10 years ago, because they've now have a decade of experience of budgeting these things and trying to be accountable for that. But even if it's $20 billion, it's still much more realistic. What does $10 billion mean? That's about the total budget of the James Webb Space Telescope, which first started off at a $500 million budget, which then ballooned to $1 billion, $1.8 billion, and now the total budget for that program is going to be $10 billion. I think the James Webb Space Telescope is awesome, but for $10 billion, we could have a rocket that could go to anywhere in the solar system and bring like 100 passengers. Sounds like a pretty good deal to me, and particularly when you think of that budget. That $10 billion is a percentage of what our cost overruns are on a lot of these naval, Air Force, and whatever programs. And we're all pretty fiscally tight here and not into like, let's start writing government checks. But if you have to choose where it goes, that would be my vote.
Well, so I'm sorry. Choose between what and what?
Between if we're going to build, spend another $10 billion on an overrun NASA program like this James Webb, spend another, let another military program, get tripled its cost or what it's supposed to do because there isn't due oversight on that.
Yeah.
Or put that money towards this.
Ooh, this is interesting because you're tickling my conflict button. Because on the one hand, you know, I firmly believe, like, let the bears pay the bear tax. Why should farmers have their money taken at gunpoint and told it'll be good? You'll be able to go to Mars in 50 years. But on the other hand, you know, that money's already collected, and if they're just doling out magic free checks, going to Mars is just as good a place as any for that money. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and I guess that's what it comes down to is, and we didn't elect a fiscally conservative president.
We have not in my lifetime elected one. The closest
we've elected ones that have preached that, but when the Trump administration talks about the idea of a $1 trillion infrastructure, you know, package and all that, who wants to spend, you know, looks at that, you know, that's a different economic model that I'd say that we're all fans of. But in that situation, I guess what I'm saying is, one, what do we think the likelihood he's going to come out here and say we're going to Mars?
I mean, the likelihood is you wait until some kind of target is hit, and then you walk up and give a speech about how that was exactly where that target needed to go. So you quietly support, like, oh, no, yeah, go ahead, do your test thing. And then, the biggest rocket of all time goes up and it lands on a barge. And who's on that barge sitting there eating Trump steaks is Trump, who's just like, I told you this is the best thing ever, and that's why I've always been in for this.
So you're not saying – you don't think in a State of the Union he's not going to say, hey, we want to go to Mars. We're going to fund this. We're going to make it happen.
I'm going to say that is a risky maneuver, and this is a man who doesn't take risks. What he does is take credit for things that happened after the fact. So he will offer some vague terminology that will allow him 3 years from now to flatly state, I told you we were going to go to Mars, and now it happened today, and it happened because of me. I'm Trump.
I actually disagree. I think that certainly for somebody that has paraded around the country and wound up getting elected saying that he was going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it, he is no stranger to making bombastic and very easily to prove or disprove kind of claims. Like, we will see at the end of 4 years whether or not he has built a wall and whether or not there is justification to say that Mexico paid for it. And that's something that he has said repeatedly. He made his, a lot of his initial headway on that idea. I think that a question like this, and this gets more into politics than it is necessarily about science, but normally you would not say this unless you really wanted to burn political capital on it. But that is, again, part of a different kind of playbook. You know, one that assumes that there is this finite amount of political capital, whereas if we're going to say that Donald Trump will govern in the same way that he ran his campaign, he doesn't care about mixed messages. He doesn't care about one thing trampling over another thing. In fact, you know, some cynically, you know, can oftentimes say that is part of what he's trying to do is to make sure that nobody focuses on anything for any long amount of time. But as a governor of the federal government, I think it's a high likelihood that this gets said. And I think at that point we need to look at who is going to carry it out. And specifically, if this is a public-private partnership with SpaceX, then I think that SpaceX has a very good track record of putting stuff up there. And if they're a partner in this, then it would make a lot of sense.
So, think about this, though. What if he – okay, you have – two alternate timelines, and there is a significantly interesting difference between how the two come out. And let's say both are generally positive, but one certainly results in more Mars exploration. What if all of Trump's rhetoric just out of nowhere, he just drops and says, you know, I don't understand why any other country besides the US should own Mars. I think the U.S. owns Mars now. I think the spirit of the United States owns Mars, and I'm going to make sure we make it happen. And he presses the nationalist button and with the target of, I mean, it's like, we could wait. We could wait until those other guys get there, or we could get there now and claim what's ours. It's our birthright. how would you feel at that moment?
I don't
know.
Manifest
destiny.
Yeah. Yeah. Manifest destiny. Right.
I would say that I think that might be the impression that I'm certainly, like, if you read his inaugural address and the interpretations many people have of it, of because it's like, it's this nationalistic America first. Well, it's like, well, America first. But if other people want to follow our lead, that's great. Or, you know, look, and it's just more, it's a little more nuanced, although that nuance is not a word we apply to him. I would say that I think that in parsing what you're saying, like, I think that for him to say, yes, we're going to go here because America's been the leader. America's the best. It's the greatest. Mars is the second greatest, but we'll make it the greatest. You know, I could see him going out and saying that. I mean, because I think that if you want to say, hey, how are we world leader? We're world leader because we're going to go to another world. You know, I think that is a powerful statement to do that. How that happens, you know, is from the how do you do that from a legal point of view is you say, hey, we're going to, you know, he's going to call in, you know, heads of, you know, all the major space contractors and say, listen, we want to go there. We want to hear your proposals and we're going to choose the best proposal, put together a committee. So it's not a, you know, a no bid sort of thing, which have its own issues and stuff. And you're going to get Lockheed. You're going to get ULA. Lockheed and ULA is Boeing, or individually you're going to get, you know, Blue Origin. You're going to get SpaceX come together and say, these are our plans to do it. And then say, okay, you know, we're going to start an initial funding of X amount of dollars based upon progress, not unlike how NASA does a number of things now. And you could move it forward for not a lot of money considering some of the things we're talking about. So my bet, and is maybe it's my wish, is that a State of the Union is that, you know, we get some sort of announcement about, hey, you know, we're going to go there and, you know, we're going to partner with other countries that want to be part of it. But this is a thing that's going to happen.
I don't see any way that can happen because so much of his message has been, I mean, there's a reason, again, was in his slogan, is that his message is, I speak to you, the disenfranchised, the people who feel like everything's gone to crap. I don't see any room in his first address to say, and that's why we're going to shoot for the stars and go to the moon. It's going to be about fixing whatever's here.
It's about being the technological leader.
I mean, but Brian, you are very, very correct for the way politics is normally done, and that you want your, all right, my first State of the Union is going to be about domestic issues, and we're going to focus on immigration, and we're going to focus on the middle class, and we're going to focus on jobs. And that's normally how it goes. That is 9 times out of 10 how it goes. I think we are just dealing with, at the very least, the possibility of Trump. I would not be shocked if he looks at the State of the Union not as this narrative crafting for what he wants to do over the next 10 years, but rather far more of just a blank checklist that includes something like space travel. I don't think that he would necessarily, if we're going to take how he campaigned, that he would blink at saying, yeah, wall, jobs, repeal and replace Obamacare, space travel, and we're doing these 19 other things that I think are very, very important. I think that in this world, that would certainly get less of a big explosion of attention, but I think it would certainly be very interesting.
All right, folks. We'll see. When is the State of the Union address, by the way?
I want to say like 20 minutes from now.
We'll find out. So we'll be curious to see. I think that he's is a person who wants to have, and also one of the things that he is either a natural at or brilliant at is the ability of to say a number of things and pick one thing that's going to get everybody talking while they ignore the other things. And controlling the narrative, as it will.
I mean, that's the trick, of course, is just say everything, and then whatever happens, you can point to a specific statement and say, you know, that's what you meant by it.
Well, yeah, but I guess, Justin's point earlier is that, you know, he has this, you know, now of issuing these tweets of saying, you know, this company is doing this because of me, or this company is doing that. It's different than when he actually sits there and actually has the legal powers to do to make things happen. You know, there's a guy that says through my rhetoric or through my promise, these things have happened. And then a guy, once he's in office, that can use, you know, the power of the pen to enact things. You know, that's going to be fairly interesting. Very interesting. So What was the date on?
It looks like usually in an election year, you'll get it in late February.
Yeah. They're technically, after the election year, they are not considered State of the Unions, I believe. And there's some concern if he even does one, says Mike.com.
Something tells me that Donald Trump will not voluntarily eschew a time to unfetter the free
shy away
and lie.
No more media, no more attention. They would have focus. Yeah,
something tells me that for
I'm
him
a private,
would be a
I'm a private man.
But you want to know what's a no-brainer for you folks? Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah, dude.
You know, it's a great a place where you can go and go ahead and kick a few shekels our way. We're only $2 away from $500 an episode. Thank you guys so much for being a part of it. Man, two milestones here just staring us right in the face. Not only $500 an episode is only $2 away, but also if for whatever reason that came with three new patrons, we would have $500 and 420 patrons.
Oh, do the right
so
thing, people.
Patreon.com/weirdthings every day. We are very, very excited that you guys support the show. And remember, if you don't pay us, we'll stop doing the show.
That's a campaign promise you can probably take not to the bank because there's no money left because he didn't pay us.
Because also we've done the show for free forever. So
also we'll probably keep on doing it no matter what, but we'll make it slightly less convenient for you, and you'll sit there flexing your fingers going like, oh, why is it so complicated to get at this show?
Flexing the fingers?
Yeah. That's all I do now. I really am in Doctor Strange mode with my droned up hand. I was a victim of a drone strike. I've been the victim of a drive-by, and the way you keep the scar tissue from being crippling is you got to flex it.
So that's all nice. Of you out there who have been hit by a drone
struck by a drone, yeah.
I mean, put your hands in the blades of a drone.
I was struck by a drone, bro. Also, the drive-by was a real last drive-by. I mean, it was a pellet gun. But
if you're doing those finger flexes, patreon.com/weirdthings.
I'm just saying.
I don't know if that was just the start of the man versus robot war or what, man.
Bri robot?
Dude, I took a HK to the – I'm like that that guy in Starship Troopers with only one arm who's like, you know, proud to begin bringing people into the infantry. He's like, I served. I'm a citizen. How about you?
Sat on the sidelines, man. Just sat on the sidelines. So, gentlemen, I'm gonna bring up another interesting little space thing. Like, why go to space? What has space ever done for us?
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Now that I think about it, it's actually kind of a valid question. You know, there's some weird stuff in space. There is actually some genuinely weird things going on out there.
Name one.
Can I get back to you next week on that?
Okay, all right, that's fine.
I don't need to because I got one right here.
Oh, good.
We've been talking, like, I know we're a little bit of a Mars focus here, but maybe we should talk about Venus given the march yesterday and all that. Don't you think that's fair? Let's talk about Venus.
Oh, all right.
So Venus, you know, Venus at first seemed really awesome. Back in old science fiction, you read Ray Bradbury and Arthur C. Clarke, they're like, yeah, Venus is it's like Earth, but it's like a steamy jungle. And we know in steamy jungles you find brontosauruses and dinosaurs and stuff. And that's what makes Venus really cool. And then we looked at Venus a little bit more and like, you know, Venus doesn't seem to rotate all that much. You know, and Venus has got this really, really thick atmosphere. And, Venus might be kind of not like Tampa, Florida warm, but kind of like, I don't know, oven warm. And it turns out that Venus is really, really, really hot, like ridiculously hot. And the Russians, to their credit, did manage to send a number of probes. While we were sending probes to Mars, the Russians were vetting on Venus with their Venera probes, sending them in there. Some of them lasted long as like, I don't know, 80 seconds before they melted, but we did get some images and stuff. Images from Venus are really kind of spooky too. I mean, Mars is you just sort of like, this kind of looks like the desert with the filter. You look at
Mars looks like the aftermath of a rave. Venus looks like, oh God, this is the living embodiment of hell happening right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Venus is this hellscape. But there is an interesting thing about Venus, and that is in the atmosphere, this very thick, hot atmosphere, there is a layer there that is actually would be temperate, would be kind of like if you were up there on a floating platform, maybe you had a little air goggles so you weren't breathing in the poisonous atmosphere, but you're out there maybe in your Speedo standing on the balcony of your floating blimp. You could probably do that. You might have some radiation issues, but point is there's a nice little temperate zone in the upper atmosphere where life as we recognize it might actually be able to survive, which is kind of interesting because when we've been taking some photos of Venus, and one of the things that we found, which is kind of peculiar, is there are dark streaks in the clouds of Venus. And even though the atmosphere has this thing called super rotation, the atmosphere moves much faster around Venus than the actual planet itself moves. But there are these clouds that appear to be almost stationary up there, despite how fast moving the atmosphere is.
I mean, just so I have a visual image to hold on to, what you're describing sounds to me like the possibility of an actual cloud city from Empire Strikes Back. Is that a potential way to think of this?
Imagine big, thick clouds that aren't moving at the same pace as everything else.
Sure, but I mean, my point is you find these pockets of equilibrium, you get a giant Zeppelin-style thing that they made out of lead, literal Led Zeppelin, and you find yourself one of those quiet spots, and you find yourself in equilibrium where you're just kind of floating. Like, we could have a city in the clouds.
Well, I mean, you could go into any other part of the atmosphere and just keep moving around like we do in our jet stream. You're going to be fine, you know. But the mystery is, why are these things here? We don't understand why these parts, these dark spots, aren't moving. And some speculation is that it might be, dun-dun-dun, life.
Wait a minute. Basically... I'm picturing flocking motions of like just let's say there's a dark speck of there's no shortage of energy, and there could be buoyancy, layers of equilibrium, you know, kind of like fish or whatever. Like when we go down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench or whatever, we find chemosynthetic life, bits of life that are just taking the heat, the raw heat, and just living on it on there. So if you had pockets of calm and you had obviously plenty of heat in a volatile area, as long as it's a quiet, turbulent eddy, why not have some kind of simple life evolve? Like, its only job is to move body to where sunlight give energy and whatever chemosynthesis works.
Yeah. You could have, it's apparently, I think it absorbs, like they found it when they look at the UV bands. And so it's absorbing some sort of inner light from there. And, you know, if I were to try to speculate on what something like this would be, is like, I would be very curious. Like, if you ever look at like a volcano from space, you see what looks like a stationary cloud. So it could be, and this is Andrew's theory, it could just be some outgassing of something from the actual surface of Venus through some sort of vortex or whatever is able to make it through all the layers up there and then spills out there and appears to be a stationary cloud. But the idea that it could be microbial, like, yeah, it's we're in this era when nobody has a problem with the idea of life in outer space. Nobody. And I get in these discussions like, well, how are the religious people going to handle it? Like, well, the Mormons kind of accept it. The Catholic Church has said that it's a possibility. Like, there's not really any part of the world that I'm aware of that it would destroy there. If they believe in an all-powerful God, then they believe this God could, you know, have other planets and have life out there elsewhere, somewhere else. So I've not really encountered a number of religious people that have a problem with that idea. And, you know, the only people who really have a big problem with the idea of intelligent life out there are, you know, people like me who are like, well, what's the likelihood and the utility of intelligence or whatever? So we do live in a period where we're like, yeah, we kind of just, you know, accept it. Possibility.
That's crazy. That's a nutty place we're in that, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, no, there's the possibility that there's life in the clouds of Venus.
Yeah, I don't. I think if that headline was there tomorrow, like, oh, we found microbial life in clouds of Venus, we'd be like, oh, cool. Yeah, one of the biggest things that happened in space in our generation was when we were kids, we had 9 planets. You know, we thought that maybe planets could exist elsewhere, but there was a speculation that maybe we just had this really weird astronomical event that allowed us to have 9 planets. And then as our telescopes got more refined and we understood how to look at very, very bright objects in small spot, tiny little specks, we started to get the first in the mid-1990s, you know, this first evidence, maybe an exoplanet. Look at the wobble of the star. We think there could be a planet there. And then overnight, it almost feels like we just accepted, like, oh, yeah, there are lots of planets. And now we're like, oh, yeah, our nearest star, planet, you know, that there are other than the sun. You know, we start finding all these things out now, and now we're cataloging thousands and thousands. And we just sort of assume every star probably has planets. And then the question is like, all right, but is it Earth-like? And now we're finding ones with habitable zones. And now we're finding, you know, ones that have, you know, the question is like, what makes Earth special? I think it makes Earth really, really special. Other than the fact that it's where our listeners live, is our moon, the size of our moon in relationship to the Earth. And that may or may not have had an effect on how life developed here, but we're not as unique anymore. And now we just take it for granted. So I think that if we started finding evidence of microbial life elsewhere, we'd be like, oh, wow, this is amazing. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, we kind of thought that was the case.
Yeah, it makes me feel like everything – is likely to happen in stages, I guess, right? So it's like right now you and I are living through the 30 to 40 year cycle where we learn that it's not special to have planets around a star, and that there's lots of planets, and it's not special to have lots of planets with habitable zones, and even those out of the habitable zones maybe have pressures that make liquid water possible, but also there's liquid methane that rains down in clouds and all that stuff. Like, let's say shortly before we die, it's like, well, it's confirmed. We definitely have found a form of life not like ours, you know, and so we die, you know, giving the middle finger at the age of 90 saying, like, told you there was other life out there. And they're like, and then, you know, our children, our great-great-grandchildren are like, yeah, but it's boring life. And it's like, well, maybe there's more interesting life out there. Oh, here's these gleep glops form in clusters of 5s and 6s and 8s. And, oh, look, these ones, pirate software. And then finally, like, every generation will have something extraordinary discovered. And also, the moment it's discovered, we'll find it less interesting to the next generation coming in, to where by the time we find by the time we encounter what the baby boomer generation assumed alien interaction would look like, I suspect it'll be a very quiet, very boring introduction, very tedious, very long, much more like a Close Encounters of the Third Kind than War of the Worlds.
Or Andromeda Strain, depending upon, you know, where you want to draw that from.
I mean, yeah, but also we're pretty good at lopping off arms when they're gangrenous, right?
No, it's all theoretical. You're the one who's come closest, Brian.
Okay. All right. Well,
so here's something to think about. Our solar system has roughly, you know, has 8 planets, possibly a 9. We got rid of Pluto, but then we may be getting back a giant mega planet, even bigger, way further out there. So we have, I'm going to call it 9 planets, right? And the problem we have is we can spot larger objects pretty easy it's easier to spot larger objects than it is smaller objects when we look at other stars. There are anywhere between maybe 100 billion to 300 billion stars or 400 billion stars in our own Milky Way. And if we use that the number of large planet-sized objects in our solar system isn't all that unusual, we could be facing a half a trillion planets in the Milky Way alone. Half a trillion. Half a trillion to a trillion. A trillion. Think about a trillion. A trillion planets in the Milky Way.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It's not several trillion. You know, but, I guess a trillion's nice.
What? No, but
tee it up.
But you know the only question anyone really cares about is we want neighbors. We don't like hey, over on this planet there's blue green bacteria, but they're yellow orange, and it's like
not in my neighborhood.
Oh yeah,
no yellow orange in my neighborhood, man.
Well, yeah. That's what we're going to segregate.
It won't let them through. All right,
we're gonna build a wall. We're gonna build a space wall.
Like, yes, you're right, Brian. Like, we want neighbors now, right? But, like, who knows what – I mean, like, a trillion planets is a trillion possibilities for any and everything that comes along in a human future that ventures off Earth.
Dude, I'm convinced that, in many different mythos of space sci-fi situations, there's talk about a precursor race that came before all the others. I think we're it, man. I think we are the precursors. And that's not to say that there's not going to be a billion different types of life and a billion different aliens and thriving colonizations and wars between Klingons and rebels and spies and all that stuff. It's going to be really, really interesting. But we are the first and very likely and the only at this moment. So our job is to set the stage and watch them all fight from the singularity.
Why are we the first, Brian?
To what level, to what degree do you want me to answer that?
I'm just a guy asking questions.
Okay, all right. Why are we the first? Well,
I'm not saying you're wrong. I just want to hear your.
The number one evidence is that we haven't encountered anyone else at the level that we are, and we're looking harder than ever. And it's getting quieter and quieter as we look out. Second of all, there's was it the life hypothesis? I forget what it is, but there's a specific theory that says the shape of our moon and the fact that having one planet with one moon is an extraordinarily unusual thing because it means it creates a period of quiet that you don't normally get in planetary science. It may be that this extremely lucky crash bang of the right asteroids at the right time left us with a single planet and a single moon. Because as we look out, even as we look out and discover moons over on and planets over on extra solar bodies, we don't see just one moon the way we see here. So not impossible that it could happen elsewhere, but extremely, extremely rare. Second of all is the fact that somebody has to be first. And here we are awake shouting as loud as we can in as many different locations as we can, seeing essentially nothing. So again, that doesn't mean we're alone. It means we're probably first. So we could be the ones to grow and reach a constraint-free economy and build robots that can easily think over periods of millennia and be there to watch the rest of the history of the universe unfold. And I'm okay with that.
Okay. I mean, I'm like, we may be the only I've gone over and over again ad nauseum about, the whole, there are all these other hominids on Earth, but only one of us kind of stuck around and, the fact that we're still early on in the universe, our nearest, Proxima Centauri is going to be around a trillion years longer than our sun, expires. So there's a trillion-year history to our universe about to happen, and we're just in the first, 16 billion, 14, 15 billion years of that. And somebody has to be first. And, you could statistically say when you're talking about a trillion planets in our own galaxy, and then you start moving into our universe, which is bigger, it would seem highly unlikely we're the first. But somebody has to be first, but it'd be more likely we could be in an early stage, but –
Well, sure. Like we're in a race, but we're in a race with other races and cultures that have none of us have achieved the ability to properly communicate with each other. I mean, we could waste. I'll not begrudge. Okay, you could do things fast, cheap, or good. Pick two. Right. We went to the moon fast and good. We did not do it cheap. Reaching out to all of the other civilizations, I don't think we've really put a lot of time, energy, or effort into yet. And for all we know, someone out there is not working on fast, but instead is working on cheap and good to open up the galactic internet. So it was.
Yeah. You know, part of the problem is when we try to look for signs of intelligent life, the further away you get from Earth, you have to be looking for intentional signals. You have to be looking for, if you're just looking in the nearest few hundred light year sort of sphere, you could sort of like, oh, we could catch stray signals. But when you start going further and further out, you're counting on the idea that they're going to be directing things towards us. And if they're not, and if they're like, nah, you know, it does. I don't put too much into the argument that we're not hearing them, they're not there. It just means that if there's, you know, the population density is significantly low enough and the window at which you're using just broad mass spectrum broadcasting, you're not going to hear them. So it could be a very, very populated universe, you know. Romans never heard from the Aztecs. It's a fact. It's a fact.
That's what I assume is happening is that – and I guess this is the weird part is because there's no way for the Romans to talk to the Aztecs, and because there's currently no way for the Aztecs to talk to the Romans, for all intents and purposes, who cares if there's Aztecs out there? Let's say a lightning bolt, Stephen Hawking goes through time.
Years before the Aztecs, that was a bad argument on my point, but you get what I mean.
No. Let's say for sake of discussion, knowing a thing that you could do nothing about is the same as not caring about the thing. If a hologram of the three of us went back to the Roman times and said, there's some people, they're Aztecs, they're over there, just FYI, peace out, and then everybody instantly believed it, then, like, what do they do with that information? What does that give them?
Yeah, I mean, if we get, you know, if imagine we got a, we found a, you know, a 1,000-year-old note in a bottle, you know, from somebody. You're like, well, that's from the Chinese, you know. I'm like, well, that's great. This person's probably dead now.
Yeah.
And this culture's probably changed a little.
So I think you're right. I think first there'll be some moment, and long after we've come to understand societies, we'll discover the intentional ways those societies were trying to reach to us.
I gotta send to Bryce this. I just looked up Aztec, and perhaps my best image ever of this, I'm going to send this to him. So, and just to talk about, like, when we get into the idea of what relatability means, and even though my hope is that I have this theory based upon every time I go around the world and I go to a major city that's been like a port city or whatever like that, they all tend to look very similar. You see commerce has this wonderful property. When you start trading with another culture or other cultures, you become very open-minded about things. You're very accepting to other – you tend to be very accepting to other, you know, cultures and conditions. And so here's this Aztec eagle warrior, which looks like the dude from Rick and Morty.
Birdman. Oh, Bird person. Yeah. Bird person.
Bird That's person. It, yeah.
Don't be gross, Tammy.
So imagine that dude comes out to greet you.
Right on. Very accepting. Like, how long are you going to be here at Dragon Con? Because that's a great outfit.
Yeah, awesome. So, all right. So I got one more space-related topic.
All right.
There was a paper, which let me find my link to this here, which talked about the likelihood of space war, saying how unlikely it would be that we would be going to a war with another alien species, and explain the unlikely interplanetary war is thankfully unlikely. This is from Nautilus magazine, by the way, which is actually a friend of mine's, one of the people who publishes that. Really fantastic science magazine, Nautilus. So check that. So it's Nautil.us. So what military theory tells us about future space war by Matthew Sadaka, who says he sees that puts forth some scenarios of why there may or may not be war, but ultimately comes to the conclusion that it's very, very unlikely.
And is the reason just because there's not a lot of money in it, or because that's a lot of resources to go out and do? Like, what if you knew for a fact that there was another podcast on the moon? And they called themselves Weirder Things, and they hated us with all their might. But their signal, the only reason we know about them is because we've sent probes, and it sounds like a crappy knockoff of Weird Things, to be honest. Like, is that – and their existence – and yes, they've stated that their intention is to be the number one Weird Things podcast in the universe, and they'll kill anyone who says otherwise. But it's like, here we are on Earth with – with our gigabits, you know, maybe saying like, you know what, let the baby have their balls.
So he quotes John Korhonen, an author and economics graduate student at Aalto University in Finland, is one of the world's handful of interstellar military theorists. Yes, these people exist. In 2013, he argued that aliens, even if possession of vastly superior technology, are very unlikely to attack us. To begin with, why would they bother? War is typically fought over resources. Almost one century ago, historian John Edwin Bakeless found that 14 of the 20 wars from 1878 to 1918 had economic motivation strongly connected to asserting control of natural resources. The number is even larger when you include wars of colonial conquest, which can be counted as no contest resource grabs. My question is, in this current day and age, when you talk about armed conflict on a global scale, it's not about resources. It's about ideology.
Go on.
Particular ISIS.
Go on.
Well, that you have the thing that really wasn't – I didn't see addressed as much in that argument was the idea of religious war. Now, we know there's a context of using – like the Crusades use religion as an excuse to go invade and steal and take these things that you want, vice versa, back and forth. You know, there were multiple aggressors in that conflict. So religion is often used as a reason to do that, but there are fanaticisms and people who are willing to say, hey, no, we're just going to – you know, we had – you know, 9/11, we had people who – you know, attacked the United States that did not have a realistic chance of obtaining any resources from that. And the scale of the conflict was certainly, you know, minuscule compared to World War II or whatever, but it was a conflict, but it was based upon an ideological point of view.
Well, and I feel like the wars of the future, I don't know if I'm diverging from your point, but I feel like the wars of the future will be measured in dollar amounts of inconveniences caused to the other mm-hmm. side. You know, like there's, you know, there are people who have an ideological dispute against the Visa Corporation or whatever. And then they're like, so they institute a DDoS. They spend real resources to tie up all of their resources. And then they crow about how, you know, for 6 hours they were shut down. We are mighty because we were loud. That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I feel like that increasingly is going to be what the 9/11s, fingers crossed, of the future look like.
Okay. I mean, so yeah, it is ideological.
Well, certainly ideological. Yeah.
Over resource based.
Yeah.
Correct.
Finding things that are vital to life, and now I will kill you because you have thing, and I need thing, or want thing, or yada yada.
Right. We live in a world where, by very real terms, a few pockets notwithstanding, a few crony capitalists notwithstanding, everything is becoming increasingly close to free, nonstop, all the time. Which means the only thing you can't control is and get out there earlier is other people's attention. All of a sudden, people's attention and their belief and their agreement is a limited resource, and it's becoming the most valuable limited resource in existence.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, I do think that this is certainly a very first world view of things. You know, there are certainly plenty of people like, you know, in that are probably having resource based conflicts in countries like Africa and stuff like that, where things are not quite as far along on the everything is getting close to as cheap and free.
Sure,
as
sure. But we're talking about trends, not yeah, you know, data absolute points. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, like, safe to say, we're at the front of the Kalasar and we see what is coming, right? And we experience it just a little bit more.
Well, but it's, yeah, I totally agree. But it's interesting when you look at, like, how when ISIL or ISIS, when they would go into certain places, the first thing they do is they would destroy monuments to store historical artifacts because, you know, they're promoting an ideology. And you know, their goal is we're going to erase this past, erase this history, and we're going to insert our own. And that's – I don't – you know, we tend – what's funny, like, is that – one of the movies that I think is a very well done movie, but I absolutely hate for the moral message is Day the Earth Stood Still, because it is to me just all the problems, the intellectualism, you know, the idea is the aliens land, this giant robot and this dude, and they come out and they tell Earth like, hey, you guys are warlike and we're going to, if you guys can't like settle your disagreements peacefully, we're going to just blow you up and annihilate you. And you're thinking, okay, So the average person in the world, you know, at the time of this movie, did not live in a free society, you know, was enslaved by, when you looked at, let's say, the communist empire, was enslaved by this regime, which did not allow them to vote, did not allow for them to have some sort of free will. You had other countries which were, you know, China and India at that point were extremely, extremely poor, resource rich, but poor as far as their ability, their economic system, whatever. And here we have these people in these shiny spaceships come down to us and say, yeah, guys, this fighting's got to stop and we're going to kill you if you don't. I'm thinking like, man, like, I think that 90% of the population was kind of a victim of like 10%. But because of the bad decisions of the 10%, you're going to annihilate everybody else. Like, where's the morality in that?
Also, it's just like they come down and they're like, we're very cross with how naughty you've been, and you will be punished for your naughtiness because you're bad anyway. And everyone's like, yeah, all right, cool, finally.
Somebody's kind of like the equivalent of just coming out, rolling up and be like, check out our sweet ride, that's because we're awesome.
Yeah,
if you want to be awesome, quit sucking so hard. Exactly. Otherwise, we'll beat you up.
Humans be dancing like this, while aliens be dancing like this.
We better see you being more awesome, or else we'll punch you really hard in the nose. Smell you later, humans.
It was like I love Star Trek Next Generation. One of my friends was actually a director of that, sweet guy, and I love the show, but it would always just sort of drive me nuts. Like, I remember, like, they had the time when, like, people who had hibernated from like the 1990s, they brought them on board the Enterprise, and somebody's talking about money or whatever, and they're like, ugh, them and their obsession with money and material wealth. Let me go over to my replicator here. All right, anyhow, yeah, those weirdos just wanting things and all that. Like, I'm going to go to my captain's cabin, the largest, most luxurious place on the spaceship here, and I'm going to give you another lecture about these people and their obsession with these material goods. You know, I have a captain's yacht, by the way, totally have my own yacht, and my family actually is rich enough to still own its own vineyard in France, but that's neither here nor where, because we've gone beyond that. We've transcended material wealth.
Yeah, well, and you know the story that was a throwaway line that somebody had put in that they retconned and made into the canon. The whole idea that they had evolved beyond money was like an accidental, like, slop job that inspired the idea of, like, oh, what would a Federation without money look like, or whatever.
Well, no, Gene Roddenberry was very weird, very anti-capitalist. Like, he actually, well, even though he was the very, very much of one him in his own right, but he was very much anti in that his own way. I mean, he talked a lot about how he was just, you know, because people loved that idea, and so he ran towards it and embraced it. So,
and then made them dollars on it.
Yeah, there was he had a if you go back in the day, you flip through like old like fan magazines like Starlog, whatever, you would see this company called like Lincoln Trading Company, which sold all sorts of like Star Trek merchandise. And I remember this because I had their catalog, the Lincoln Trading Company, like, and like all this weird Star Trek stuff. I thought it was weird, like, how they got that license and stuff. That was Gene Roddenberry's company.
No,
Gene Roddenberry created this company to do this. And do you remember, like, you know, the infinite diversity, infinite whatever, you know, medallion they had with like the triangle and the star or whatever?
No, I don't.
So this was showed up like in like third season original Star Trek. It was a thing that like Spock wore or whatever. Apparently Roddenberry literally walked on set, says, I need you to wear this. I need you to say this is what this is.
Oh, no kidding.
Product placement, folks.
All right, hold on. This sounds like a really good idea. So what you should do is maybe have some product that belongs in a popular franchise. So then that way people wanted to go, and it's called SCAMSTUFF.com. All right. No, this is good. This is good.
Well, fun times. There we go. Lincoln Enterprises, a subsidiary of the Norway Corporation. So that's the story on that. So anyway, that's what I read. But
that's amazing.
Gentlemen. Speaking of journeys.
Dude, we're on the road.
Think we have it. Do we need it? Can we get a competent recap of what happened so far?
Dude, last I heard, we were in a big rig about to infiltrate Diamond City on behalf of his beshness over at Diamond Town. And granted, we didn't get the vehicle that I selected, but we are half on our way. We tune in. We're hearing what appears to be reruns of Daily Tech News Show as we get ever closer to those gilded big city lights of Diamond City.
Also, we have collars on that seem to be poised to explode should we not make it back in time.
But it should be noted they are very fashionable. Like, we do – you can't deny the fact that we look more badass with them on.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, it's nighttime now. You're driving up a hill. Just beyond, you see the glowing lights of Diamond City. Yeah, and for those of you just tuning in now into this madness, Brian may or may not have an implant inside of him that gives him superpowers and perhaps the voice of Adolf Hitler.
The advice, he didn't say it's statistically impossible that everything he said was wrong. So, like, just hold on to that.
Quote, you heard it here first, guys. Quote, Hitler had some good ideas.
That's one way to put it.
Do you dispute that?
I don't know. Let me ask Adolf. Adolf, what do you think of all this anti-Adolf talk? Boogin. He says, playing the chicken dance.
So you see this glow over the horizon. All right. Now, is your plan to just, like, drive over the hill, or are you going to, like, be tactical about it?
Well, I mean, we see the glow. I would think we would pull over on the side of the road, and if only we had a two-wheel silent human-powered device to get close to the edge.
We got directions from the spy that we met in the basement when we were still under captive. We were talking to the spy who was there from Diamond City.
Yeah.
To infiltrate. So I assume we are using whatever information that he gave us to get in.
All right. So you're coming up with the hill, then all of a sudden you see a couple figures on the hill holding large tubes, silhouettes, large tubes on their shoulders.
Okay. We drive right past them.
You sure? You sure that even though, like, that what may or may not be rocket launchers?
I mean, the only one way to find out, and that's to drive right past them. Just drive right on past.
So, well, you're a distance away. It's like you can't just, like, you know, they're going to, like, you.
Oh, okay. All right. I grab the speaker and I say, hey, here, turn on the echo. I say, hey, y'all.
We's coming.
What y'all got? What's up with the tubes?
So all of a sudden, a giant flare goes up, illuminates you guys. You're very, very brightly lit. Okay. You hear bam, bang, two bang sounds, and are you ready for this? A red light starts flashing in your semi-tractor trailer truck, though, and along drops an instrument panel that says missile, flamethrowers, all sorts of weapons.
All right, look, Justin, I'm going to drive. You got the weapons control, all right? I just figure we're going to stick to the road, and you take them all out. You ever play a little game called Battlezone? It's finally happening.
All right. This is our big plan, and this is what the information that we got from the spy was, that we are just going to go guns blazing into enemy territory.
Unless you got a better, I mean, I could ask Adolf, hold on, Adolf, run scenarios on possible stealth infiltration given current information.
Well, based upon my success in Northern Africa, I say do it.
All right. Maybe this is not.
Oh, and invade Russia during the winter. Great idea.
Yeah, Adolf's all of Adolf's advice is going to be pick more fights and fight them all simultaneously. Yeah.
Okay, so I swerve to the left to buy us a little bit of time.
Crap. Well, you want to know what? No, hell. The last time that we got into one of these sticky situations where we had to make a split-second decision, it was me who made the decision, and I got all these kids killed, and I never heard the end of it. So you want to know what? You want to just go blow everything up? Then let's go blow everything up.
Okay,
fine.
So here's I say, reach over, grab that 8-track, rip out those cords, plug this in back behind my ear, and I start, and I say, Adolf, play Flight of the Valkyries as we show up.
I'm sorry. I do not know what Flight of the Valkyries is. Did you mean Ride of the Valkyries?
Yes. Whatever. No, because I just searched. Play the damn music, because we're just going to show straight up. All right, here we go. I start driving as fast as I can. Justin, I want you to fire all of our weapons straight up in every weapon. What do you have available?
What do I have available? Is it missiles?
Missiles, you've got something called the very inappropriate German I was about to say. The Wunder Stomper, the Kinder Stomper.
Yes,
and the Shit Blaster.
Press them all! Press them all! I'm 70 miles an hour!
I press them all and I shoot them all in every direction.
The windshield's painted up with lasers. Red lasers are painted on your windshield.
Initiate double middle fingers.
And you hear a boom! Big, huge explosion. Boom! But another one. Something's launching. So what are you doing? Are you launching everything?
I'm launching everything.
You're pressing all the buttons like a madman, mashing them?
I'm also kind of juking left and juking right, trying to avoid giant craters.
45 caliber machine gun fires coming out of the front of your rig as you're swerving back and forth. I thought Justin was driving, but that doesn't matter. And all of a sudden, you're just shooting a barrage of bullets. You see ray tracers going up there. There are people running up to the hills. They're just dropping down like this. The guys with the things, the cylinders on their shoulders, they're just flying backwards, and you're seeing some sort of, like, you know, thing fly out and just sort of waft away in the wind, and all of a sudden there's explosions going on behind the hill. You see a big glow. Boom, boom, boom. More explosions
right,
and stuff.
Real quick. I grab the CB radio, turn on the echo as I shout, Fear not. We come in peace. Keep hitting all the buttons, Justin.
Apparently the PA system doesn't... You drive up and you see your first row of bodies, and you see the cylinders on their shoulders, right? And you're like, got them, right? You come over the hill and you press the buttons again and you start firing again. You see the whole place is lit up everywhere. There's fires, there's explosions, but there's still bombs going off. Boom, 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 left and right. And then you're like, those aren't bombs, those are fireworks. And then boom, something hits your window and you're like, oh my God, we just got hit, but it's a T-shirt.
Oh, right on. Well, then, real quick, I press pause on the deck, and I lean over to Justin and I say, I think we might have been a little bit wrong on what we're doing.
T-shirt just says, "Happy birthday, Brian."
Oh, great. Okay. Well, so I switched the music. Keep shooting all the weapons straight up, Justin. It's important.
You're out of ammo. You're just bodies everywhere. Bodies
make
everywhere.
Sound effects.
I'm gonna refuse that order, Brian. I think we've murdered dozens.
No. Well, we just were shooting around the fireworks.
Oh, they're all wearing like birthday hats. There's a giant cake with, oddly enough, do we have an image of that cake, of what the cake was?
Yeah, hold on. It's going to take a minute for the radar images to come.
There's a giant cake. There's birthday hats. There's everywhere. It's a big festive celebration. There's Diamond Club shirts, you know, and there's a big banner overhead says, "Happy birthday, Bri. Welcome home, Diamond Club."
I look at my watch. Adolf, what day is today?
The week after your birthday, Brian, but, you know, the news does not travel so much yet.
Yeah, not good enough. I say fire up the radio, let's ride into town. we clearly made
any
it past.
Any excuse to play them.
You're now in the middle of town, Brian.
All right, hold on. Real quick, we got to let anyone know we're coming. There you go. Just rolling slow. And I'm just real quick. If anyone wants trouble, we're trouble. We come from Diamond Town.
They're all dead. They're all dead.
We're announcing that we're from Diamond Town.
Yeah, that's right. Diamond Town wins.
Yeah.
All right, cut off.
So you're like, your buttons, there's no more gunfire.
Diamond
there's
City.
There's no more ability to fire bullets. You get out of the semi and you look and you just see about half the people that showed up, you know, to your one of your Diamond Club events and Dragon Con. They're all dead. Murdered.
I put on sunglasses and say Diamond City, more like Diamond Shitty.
No, you don't. We don't say that.
Oh,
that,
okay.
That's not something that we say.
Okay, well, all right. Then what do we do?
What do you do?
Well, we continue to roll into town. It's now a bloody mess.
Murder cake.
So we go, Andrew. We roll up to the gates of the town. Do we see anybody living? Is there chaos beyond?
Oh no! Oh no!
So the whole city has just been totally destroyed and decimated.
Wait, there's somebody running towards you. They look like you know, a friend. Look at a friend, like, hey guys. And it's like he's got, like, you know, it's the Harambe t-shirt. You know, he's like, we thought it would be funny. And then all of a sudden, like some fireworks that got knocked over, he gets hit by like a big cloud explosion thing, and boom, and he just blows up right in front of you.
Okay, so
oddly enough, as you start looking at the faces, and not a single one of them is one of our Patreon supporters.
I see, that makes sense.
Telling distinction. Okay, so what could we notice about life in Diamond
City? Like they have power, right? Because the lights are still on and it's evening.
Yeah, the lights are on. It's they're festive lights.
The lights are on, but there's nobody home. All right. So we walk through the throngs of bodies, kind of kicking them over, taking a look at the faces. We don't recognize a single one of them, huh?
No, you do. You recognize half, like, it's half of the people who showed up at your Dragon Con event.
Yeah, but are they the ones we liked?
They're all ones we like, Brian. I mean, like, also, We really have no real friends in Diamond Town. Neshcom's gone crazy and is now some bizarre glitter despot. We have no idea who is here. We thought that they were hostile. Obviously, that's not the case. We rolled into a very, very, very docile community of our friends and murdered all of them without much of a warning. And now all I'm trying to find out is who runs Diamond City, so we can at least formalize a surrender at the very least and get some answers here.
Justin, I want you to look over your shoulder to the left. I want you to listen to that whistling wind. And I want you to look at my eye when I say, you want to know who runs Diamond City?
I walk away before he even gets to the punchline. I mean, I walk away.
As you walk away, I'm like, oh, come on. They're all dead.
I put my fingers in my ears and I say, nah.
It's a fine city. Somebody's got to run. It ain't going to run itself. We got to protect.
So you hear a whoop, 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 whoop sound of a helicopter approaching, right? And you look up and you're stirring up. There's a helicopter approaching, big, huge, like actually like Chinook, whatever. And it's very brightly lit, by the way. It's actually got flashing lights and what sounds like might be some sort of club music playing. Okay. It flies overhead. The door swings open. There's bright flashing lights. And who do you see?
It's a fantastic Phasmismo. The Admiral of Awesome, the Cardinal of Crap Kicking,
wearing Scott like the Johnson. Silver encrusted, bright shining with little glowy line flight suits, and he just flips both of you off.
Wait, hold on, real quick. I engaged the PA so he can hear me all the way up there. Hey, Bryce. We did your job to you.
It's like just flips you off. And then all of a sudden he reaches in and he pulls out a giant – there you go. Just like he pulls out a remote control, presses the button. And remember the collars are on your necks?
Yeah.
You hear doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot. And next time on Journey Quest.
We're wearing live bombs and we've murdered a whole city.
I mean, we knew that though.
You're not even going to let us keep it.
Yeah. So – gentlemen, we have picks.
I mean, Diamond City seems pretty dope.
Hey, I have a pick. I watched Sherlock the last season, and I really did not like the first episode. I like the second episode a lot more, and the third episode. Like, I just want to know if Stephen Moffat knows that Doctor Who and Sherlock Holmes are different characters. I don't think that by watching that third episode that features pretty much everything, in, like everything up to magical realism, like, you know, that there's just a lot of like random little things that are in this like futuristic place, and everything works and it's all networked, and there's all these like, you know, it's like in Doctor Who and science fiction, you can just randomly have a big thing pop up on a wall and it's like, yes, they're wall TVs. Everybody in Ding Dong Kingdom has them and whatever. Like that's fine. But when you're supposed to be in a little bit more of a realistic situation. And I thought the second episode really went a far way to kind of get into that and to show the more realistic boundaries that can make Sherlock stories so interesting in any incarnation, and certainly when that show is at its peak. But I don't know. It put me in a situation where I kind of really, like, I'm always a fan of more of everything. But, like, man, I kind of think maybe we should just, you know, take a knee on this Sherlock thing going forward. Maybe it's fine. The last episode was called The Final Problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe it should be The Final Problem.
What the audience can't see is the smug look on Andrew's face.
Well, however will they know that it's there then?
I've been saying this about Sherlock since like season two. I'm just... my memory palace. I'm like, just see, my wife just shot you in the side there because I'm like, this is the dumbest show about a smart person I've ever seen. So I'm not into it. If you love it, I'm happy you love it, and I won't talk you out of it. But I gave up on that show.
Yeah, and like I said, I think I was talking about it last week where it was like, maybe it was on Cord Killers. Like, I watched the first episode and I was like, I really didn't like it. And I also reminded me so much of how frustrated I was with the previous season. And I will say that the justification that they used to set in motion at the end of the third season, I found how they dealt with what should have been the central conflict of this season. I found the execution on that sorely, sorely, sorely lacking.
Right on. Hey, so I went back and revisited a podcast that I'd probably tuned out of maybe a year ago. Maybe I've listened to one or two episodes in the last year. And yet it was a podcast that I think was very inspirational and very formative for the dynamic that later has become Night Attack. And it, I think, is one of those things where when you admire something, you risk becoming a pale shadow of it. So there was a good hot minute that I just didn't listen to this podcast at all. But I went back and revisited and was delighted on two fronts. One, to know that Night Attack is nothing like it and never will be, and we don't have nothing to fear. But also because it's still incredibly funny and engaging, and I love it. Kevin Smith's Smodcast, if you never got around to diving into his relationship, his friendship with Scott Mosier, a particularly poignant episode is where they do one. It's just an hour and a half of them remembering Carrie Fisher, and not in the theoretical way that so many of us do, but in a very visceral way where they talk about the actual experiences they had with her and what it meant when they received the unfortunate news of her passing.
Excellent. I have loved this podcast. I'm probably a couple years behind it, but it absolutely was just, I think, one of the most influential podcasts on showing, like, I think, what it could be and the power of somebody like Kevin Smith, who is just an amazing raconteur, his ability to tell a story. I saw him speak live at Star Wars Celebration years ago, and it was just extemporaneous, heartfelt talk about Star Wars and what it meant for him. It was a really, really neat thing to see, and I think that his podcasts are absolutely fantastic. So I'm gonna double down on your pick, Bri. I'm gonna piggyback on that.
No, ain't nothing wrong with that either, because he's still got it good. And I was talking to, I forget what out of context thing it was, but we might have mentioned this on Night Attack, but it's like, I was in my mid-30s when I first heard Smodcast, and it was, you know, the introspection that comes with somebody who has had a run doing one thing, turning 40, and I kept waiting to see, like, well, what happens to you after you turn 40? And it just has been so much fun over the last 5 years to hear Kevin Smith give fewer and fewer F words and be happier and happier every time I hear him. And I'm sure there are things that still set him off, and he's paper skin thinned on other things. But by and large, that is a dude that every day, every time I hear him, it sounds more like he's gotten right with his life and his family and the things that matter, and is less and less enamored and enchanted by the Hollywood game, which is delightful.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely agree. He was able to find sort of like the real value is in your friendships and your relationships with people, not what stardom or whatever is the allure of that. You know, it's having people who you care about you on a real level. And you see that when he does a podcast, you see that when he talks to people, and that's really cool. I'm going to do kind of a pick. You'll hear it's going to be a selfish pick here, sort of a selfish sort of like thing, if I may indulge.
Yeah.
Just for you Magic fans out there, I'm going to be announcing next week what's called Illusion XX or Illusion 20. It is, I started creating magic effects when I was a teenager, and I put a bunch of every single illusion book and plan that I've put out into one ginormous volume. Actually, there's going to be a hardcover edition. This was just sort of my paperback proof, and I'm going to be announcing details on that later this week. So it is, if you have any interest in magic or illusion,
dude, for the record, even if you just care about the three of us jokesters, it is Andrew's work as an illusionist. It is I want to say Shock Effects, it might have been a different book, but where I first read a magician friend of mine had one, and this is back in the days that they were spiral bound and so on, and handed it to me. I sat down, read the whole thing in like 2 or 3 hours, and I was like, this guy gets it. Lots of real clever stuff. I deeply resent his talent, and if I ever end up on a podcast with him, I'll make sure to shoot lasers at him.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for the lasers. Yeah, that was a Shock Magic was a book I put out there because I was trying to find out, like, how do you do the nail in the head? And I couldn't find, like, concise resources on that stuff. And I finally found, like, you know, like some Indian magic magazines or whatever, which talked about it. And I'm like, and I never knew anybody who did blockhead, never knew anybody who knew how to do that. And so there I am by myself with a nail, a hammer, and my phone ready to dial 911.
Dude, you and me both, man. We both came from the school of trial and error. And I think it's fair to say neither of us recommend anyone else do that same method. Buy this book instead.
Yeah, this is just all of my, it starts with my first book I ever wrote on illusions called Solo X, which was one man illusions. I was thinking about the problems of being like a cruise ship magician and trying to find new assistants and train them again. And the idea of having a show where you could just, the magician would be the center of everything that happens, which, you know, the very good and pro and con to that, but it was a way, every book I ever put out there was trying to think there was, every book I ever put out there was trying to figure out how do you approach that? How do you approach that? And from there, that was an extremely huge selling book. That was a book that had magic that it went on to go appear in the stage acts of magicians around the world. And that led to other books and continued on through Solo X Illusion Effects. And I created, you know, started creating illusions that were easy to build. That was one of the things that I became kind of most noted for in the magic creation circles with illusions, was how to take corrugated plastic or cardboard boxes and create stuff you could go on stage and fool people with. So that is where that went from. So
I will just say this about Andrew's work in illusion building. Magic, and specifically stage magic, can very, very often be a kind of stagnant artistic place. And I think that that's a frustrating element for anybody who's followed that industry. And what Andrew, I know, has been amazing at doing is not only doing very interesting and thought-provoking and trying to move that art form forward, but also trying to do it as economically as possible, and not even necessarily in how you're building stuff, but just in how you can use it and thinking of the full stem to stern experience of like, yeah, this is great, but also this is going to pack a way that will be beneficial to you, or this is going to be something that is, you know, very, it is there for experimentation. It's there for you to make your act better. And I think that that's something that very often is sort of, you know, forgotten, I think, in especially stage magic, where it's a lot of, you know, advancing a act is like, well, now I have enough money to buy a blank. Great. I have a blank now. Let me figure out a good routine to put around my blank. And that's just sort of it, as opposed to, you know, trying new things and trying different and cool ways to do it. And I think that's what Andrew's always been fantastic at. And that's going to be on showcased in that book.
Thank you, sir. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
German Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.